Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Caton. So much for the intro music. Wow, that sounded terrible. All right. Infinite Tennis is the pesky guy who might not have the same measure of speed, power, absolute shot-making technique, but always plays smart and is a tough out. Infinite Tennis references cult classic sci-fi films. Infinite Tennis is the guy who almost never loses to lower-ranked players and is the guy no one looks forward to playing, even if they feel confident about the outcome. We have Alan Fox on the show today, and he had a nice career as a player, coach, very noted tactician, sports psychologist, brain surgeon, rock star, astrophysicist. No, wait, that's Buckaroo Banzai. Great news, as we have a new sponsor, Pocket Radar, and we'll have a short segment with a famous teaching pro at the end here who uses Pocket Radar to great effect. Also on August 10th, we'll be having a contest to give away a one Pocket Radar unit. Contest will be in the form of questions to answer about Pocket Radar, information gleaned from past episodes of Infinite Tennis, so do your homework. More rules to follow. So, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back with Alan Fox. We go to a very important piece of information.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Hello, Alan. Are you there?
I am, Bill. Good morning.
Excellent. It's been nice to get acquainted with you over the last couple of weeks. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing fine. Ready to speak with you and maybe some of your listeners.
Okay, excellent. So tell us a little bit about where you're from originally and how you got started with tennis and how that all, how did you decide that you really wanted to play the game and all that?
Well, I came originally from Tucson, Arizona. I lived right next to the U of A, actually about a block away. And when I was 13 and a half, I was almost 14, my mother decided that I should play tennis. She liked the game. I didn't have any particular interest in it. But she brought me over to the U of A courts, and she hired one of the University of Arizona players to give me about an hour and a half of lessons and two lumps. Sort of showed me the strokes, and then she sent me to the backboard and insisted that I practice an hour a day. This went on for a couple of weeks. And then there was a small tournament in Tucson. Of course, Tucson at the time, this is in 1953 or so, had 25,000 people. And so I was entered in the 15 and under category, and I made the semifinals. Of course, I made the semifinals because there was only four players. So I was immediately... And I had a pretty good match with the kid that won it, although I hadn't learned to serve yet. I was serving underhand. I'd figured out that if I tried to serve regularly, I would double fault and lose for sure. So that did it for me. It was basically just the competition and the thought that I wasn't that far off that made me play more. And so after that, I started to practice as much as I could. I went to New York, visited my cousin, which I did every summer out in Long Island, and there was a country club there, and so I would go basically most of the day, hang around the courts, and hit as many balls as I could. And weirdly enough, I was a medium. I was a pretty good athlete, not a great athlete, but within a year, about a year and a half, I was the number two player in Arizona. And so,
wow.
Yeah, which isn't saying much, by the way. Arizona was pretty weak. But it's sort of it's sort of weird how quickly you can make a jump. And I'll give you the example. What happened was, and this is into the summer, and so, as I said, I'd been playing... I played the previous summer, and I had about a year and a half of tennis in me. And just before the summer started, they had a... Am I going on too long? Maybe.
No, you're fine.
Can you take in there, Bill, for a minute?
Yeah, no, you're doing great. I want to hear.
Okay, well, it's sort of an odd story. And so they had a junior 15 and under tournament called the Junior Chamber of Commerce Tournament. They don't have it anymore, but if you were the winner of that tournament in your state, you got a free trip back east to play in the National Junior Chamber of Commerce. So I played, I got to the finals, and then I lost to this kid, Barry Edberg, a little lefty from Phoenix, and he like softballed me, lobbed every ball, and he beat me love and love. I didn't get a game. And so that did it. With my tail between my legs, I went back to New York, and I'm, you know, playing out at the Roslyn Country Club, and my older cousin, Fred, who was 1 year older than me, said, "Hey, Alan, you know, you're the number two player in Arizona. Why don't you see if you can get an entry into Kalamazoo, the national championship, because, you know, you're number two in the state." Of course, I wasn't very good since I lost love and love to this kid that wasn't very good. But anyway, I contacted the authorities, and they got me an entry into Kalamazoo.
Wow.
So now I'm entered in Kalamazoo. I'm in New York. I have no money, of course. So my cousin and I, my older cousin and I, we got on a bus, and we took the bus. We made it about as far as Toledo, Ohio. Then we hitchhiked from there to Kalamazoo. And we got there in the evening, and the gym... The gym there had an open window, so we snuck into the gym and slept on benches that night. The mosquitoes were getting. Anyway, that was kind of how I started. I played the tournament about a couple of days later. I'd never seen a clay court or anything of the sort. I played the tournament, and I decided, you know, that this Edward kid beat me love and love by just highballing me, lobbing sort of, you know, maybe 15 feet over the net. So I said, well, you know, maybe I'll try that. And so my first match was the number one player from Texas, who was actually a player. I mean, he could play, not like the Arizona kid. And so I highballed him, just sort of lobbed every ball, and I beat him. And so my next match was against the number two seed, in the, a great player named Earl Buckholz, who later became a touring pro and so forth. Anyway, he was the second seed. And so I started highballing Buckholz as well. Just sort of lobbed every ball. And I won the second set. And so he did beat me in the third.
Yeah.
But suddenly, I was a player. You know, I beat the number one player from Texas, and I won a set off of Buckholz. So I went back to New York again with my cousin, and the big New York tournament was called the New York Metropolitan, which was a huge tournament compared to where I came from. I played it the year before and lost to a guy named Ron Holmberg, Love and Love. So now in this tournament, the next time I'm playing it, they seed me first. I'm the top seed in this big tournament. I never won a tournament in my life away before this. So I'm the top seed, and I continue to highball everybody. And I win the tournament.
Okay. Wow.
It was a weird thing. And suddenly, you know, I got ranked 35 in the country in the 15 and under. I went back to Arizona, and suddenly everyone thinks I'm a player. And I start winning tournaments. And now I don't really have to highball as much. But for whatever reasons, it just shows you that there are these sort of psychological jumps of some sort, especially when you're young, when you really don't know and people don't know how good you are. And suddenly you think you're pretty good. And I started winning the tournaments in Arizona as well. And, you know, in within 6 months, I was actually the best 18 and under in the southwestern states, the Arizona, New Mexico, and sort of West Texas.
Yeah. Hey, so Al, I think that's a very fascinating to me because, I mean, it points out a couple different things. I mean, number one, the helicopter parents of today would never allow that, you know. So I think, you know, I think one of the lessons there is the independence that you had with your brother to go hop on a bus. I mean, I think that's awesome. And, you know, that's a bygone era. I mean, I remember I'm probably the next end of the generation from you, but I just remember being free to roam. And it was basically, you know, get home before dark because that's dinner time. And, you know, we pretty much roamed and did whatever we wanted to do. And that was the kind of freedom that I think it helps someone develop their full range of possibilities. So I think that's very,
and there's
very
no reason.
Good.
It's
a very good, instructive story. And, you know, it also shows that, yes, if you get beat by something, maybe you should adapt that into your own game because obviously it can work. You know, you need more than just the moonball game. All right, let's shift gears for a little bit. Let's go on to a little bit about your pro career. And so, you know, how long did you play the tour, and what were some of your landmark wins that you had?
Well, let me just say one thing on the point you made about protective parents that wouldn't let their kid ride a bus that far or even let them walk to school. It is actually not really rational. I think there's sort of a fear factor going on. For instance, when I was seven, I used to walk to school. It was about a mile away. I had to actually cross a couple of pretty big streets, and there was never a problem. All the kids walked to school. Nowadays, the biggest risk a kid has is going to be to get hit by a car, and that was the risk then when I was a kid. It's the risk now. Parents are very, very overly protective now. It's the risk that some lunatic's going to grab your kid is like astronomically small. You know, it's the cars that are the issue, and that's no different than it ever was. Anyway, just want to make that point because
Okay, so let's go on to your career there. Thank you for that comment. So
anyway, by the time I was 16, I was the number one junior in Arizona. I could beat everybody. And so my parents moved to Los Angeles. It was actually just my mother. My father had passed away. Moved to Los Angeles so I could get better competition. And pretty quickly, within about a year, a little more than a year, I was the number one player in Southern California. I won the Southern Cal Juniors. This time I'm 18. And so I got ranked 7 nationally and made the Junior Davis Cup team. Actually, I won that national JC tournament in my last year in the juniors. I won the national, and that gave me a spot on the Junior Davis Cup team. And so from there, it was a scholarship at UCLA. In my first year, I alternated between 1 and 2 on the team. By my senior year, I was solidly number one. I shouldn't say solidly, but I was number one. I won the NCAA singles, and I'd won the doubles the year before. And then I sort of made a jump my senior year. Here's another story that might be useful to players.
Okay. Alan, let's hold off on another story for a moment. I need to run another ad, and then we'll come back and get the story. You know, also as we move forward, I definitely want to get more into kind of the principles and the books and the, you know, keys to development for our listeners. So here we go. We're going to do one more ad, and we'll be right back.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At USSportCamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit USSportCamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. And so, Alan, briefly give us another story, and then let's run through some quick questions because time is ticking pretty quick.
Okay, let me make one point about what I said before, and that is actually you can get quite good much more quickly than people think. And the one thing I had going for me was I was a fanatic practicer. I mean, I knew that the more balls I hit, the better I was going to get. So I spent every minute I could on the court. And what happened was it didn't take 4 years. By 5 years of tennis from scratch, I could give men in the top 10 in the United States, I could give them trouble. I'd give them a good game. I couldn't beat them yet. But you can get to be a nationally ranked player within 5 years if you play all the time. I mean, on a Saturday, I'd get up at 7 and have a match, and I'd play till dark. You know, I'd play 15 sets of tennis one Saturday. So that trick number one, it doesn't take, you know, forever to get to be a factor. You know, you get about as good as you're going to get sooner than people think. And point two, it comes in jumps. You know, you don't think you're improving because you can't see it. You practice. You don't seem to get any better because it happened to me in my junior year at UCLA. I actually went down to number 2 on the team. Practicing as I was, this one player, Larry Nagler, beat me all the time. And so I went down to number 2. But then in my senior year, I made a jump suddenly, you know, and I beat Larry and won the NCAAs. And suddenly I was winning big tournaments. That summer I won Cincinnati, which was and still is a big tournament. Bigger was Southampton, which was one of the tour tournaments leading up to Forest Hills, the U.S. Open now. So it all happened quickly, you know, but in jumps. And so to tennis players, they don't think they're getting any better. Actually, if you hit a lot of balls, you are improving. You might not see it because confidence is what will lead to the jumps. And those things...
On that point, do you think it's true that... you think it's true that when you hit a plateau, that part of that is a coping mechanism because you know, it's stressful to always be undergoing change. So to be going upward is too stressful for our minds.
Well, you got two or three things. You got two or three things going there in that question. Quite a tricky one. But to go after one thing, people generally plateau. They plateau, or they even go down. But there's an overarching like fact of physiology, you know, whatever, and that is, habit strength is directly proportional to repetitions. Okay, I mean, if you hit the forehand 1,000 times, it's going to be a stronger habit than it would be if you hit it 900 or 500. Every time you hit it properly, you're ingraining a habit, which is the entire object of practice, basically, is habit development. And so when you say you plateau, what you're really saying is that maybe your tournament results or your match results don't show much. They're not showing anything. It doesn't mean your game, the habit, because your game is built on this habit strength. When you play a match, you don't make the habit better or worse. You just hope the habit comes out. You try to control the emotion during the match, and you rely on the habits carrying you through. And so as long as you're hitting more balls, there is not a real plateau. The apparent plateau is just a confidence issue. You know, you may take some losses. If you think about it, you know, say you've been playing tennis 10 years. I mean, you've hit a million strokes already. So if you go out and hit another 1,000, you're not going to see much difference in the short run. All right? But and so you may think you've plateaued. You may hit 10,000, not much difference. You know, if you hit 100,000, yeah, there'll be a difference. But confidence will make 25% jumps one way or the other in your game. And so it way overbalances what you might be seeing on the practice court, but it doesn't mean you're not getting better.
Okay. Wow. Thank you. I'm a little flabbergasted because that was such a great deep answer right there. All right. Let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about who were some influential players or coaches with you who helped you along, because so far, it sounds like you were self-taught, but then did you have any coaches that came along and helped you out?
Well, I did have a couple of coaches that helped me out. I was mostly self-taught, 90%. I just watched the other guys and whoever was doing well. I wanted to see why it was and copied. But there was a pro named Frank Feltrop that helped me with my volley, and there was another pro named Carl Earn. I think both were more motivational and positive people for me. I mean, Carl was just a positive person. And so the game should be fun. I mean, for me, the whole thing was fun. I mean, it was exciting and kind of a project that I could see that I was getting better at. And so the whole thing was fun. But it wasn't. There wasn't a lot of great technical coaching done in my day. At least not by anybody I saw. I had to figure it out myself. But interestingly enough, other than my forehand, my strokes were very technically sound, just through trial and error. I mean, my forehand, I didn't quite have the strategy on it. My backhand was very good. I used a topspin backhand in the 50s when that wasn't very common. A lot of people were slicing them.
Right.
And for my height, my serve was quite good. But it was all kind of trial and error. I was with my serve, I watched some kid who, you know, kind of bent way back, and he hit a tremendous kick on it, and I could see the ball had sort of an egg-shaped look. It had so much spin. And so I went out trying to get an egg-shaped serve. And what that did was I was trying to get more and more racket velocity, because that's the essence of, you know, the power of the serve, or power of any stroke, is racket velocity. And so I kept trying to get more and more racket velocity. I kept rotating farther and farther. My serve, I rotated my body away very, very far. You know, my arm was relaxed, I was snapping my wrist, and I was, you know, everything was getting into the serve. And so it was kind of natural to develop a normal serving action.
So you bring up a great point right there, and I think there's a lot of truth, and it can be helpful for, I think, some people, but maybe not everybody, but to look at the outcome of the kind of shot that you want to produce first, and then examine what are you going to have to do to your technique to make that happen. But I think the danger there is that people might have a maladaptive stroke that they develop, and it may lead to injury. So I think that's where you want another pair of eyes on you to say, what do you think of this technique? Because I think someone else looking is going to see where it may break down. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think just the whole coaching thing, I think coaching is quite a valuable aspect of the whole process. But most kids don't need as much coaching as they get. And I think over-coaching is somewhat destructive in a way. But if someone can teach you the fundamentals, there are basics about all the strokes. If you've got the basics, I mean, essentially, I can tell you the basics right now, most of them, and that is you basically want your arm flexible and relaxed. You want to get most of the racket velocity by rotating your body. You know, you turn away and you get your back facing where you're going to hit the ball, and then you sort of rotate and step forward, let your arm come through, and you get most of your power through rotation. You're going to get some from your hand and your wrist and so forth, and that you'll develop naturally. But the essence of most of the strokes are rotation and relaxation and just getting into position early. So you have yourself all wound up before the ball gets to you, so you don't have to rush it and use your arm. That was my problem with my forehand, was I used my arm. I had a big topspin forehand, but I didn't use my body enough. I swung it with my arm, my arm and my wrist. It made for a dangerous stroke, but the danger was more to me than anybody else.
That's great. That's great. So we both have tricky last names, right? I mean, and as a fox, I suppose you're like an unpredictable strategist, right? And my last name, there's an expectation that there's going to be tactics and strategy, right? So tell me why a coach might tell his high school players to lob short and rush the net.
Because he hates them and he wants to see them get hit.
No, my reason for that is because I want to make sure that they're using their critical thinking skills. So, like you said, I think this goes hand in hand with the over-coaching thing, is that when coaches overcoach, then players naturally tune them out. And so you might I think it's a great idea when coaches say things that are ridiculously wrong, and then the teenager can say, hey, wait a minute, coach, I don't think that's going to work. And then you go, yeah, good, you passed the test. You're actually listening, paying attention. Because the natural thing with coaching a teenager is they're going to want to rebel. They don't want instruction. And then another thought I had was that when coaching player and you're going to be spending a lot of time with them, do you think it's a good idea to, in the early going, kind of indoctrinate them in your philosophy, and then as you go, kind of become more silent and more observational, and then also ask them to tell you what they're doing wrong? What do you think of that?
I think that's accurate. It depends what your philosophy is. You know, I just see a lot of overcoaching, and what it does do is makes the player more dependent and less thinking for themselves, less adaptable. I mean, you need the fundamentals, maybe once a week, twice a week with a pro. I mean, a lot of guys are taking lessons three, four times a week, and they're going into these clinics all the time. I mean, the best practice you get is to get another player that hits a butt like you do, and you hit cross courts, you hit down the line, you practice strokes, you know, in a practice situation. You don't need to be fed balls out of them. And I shouldn't say this because, you know, I have a lot of respect for people that are pros. They do quite a good job in general. To me, of course, it's a function of my experience. Most kids don't need quite as much, you know, basketball feeding as they get. Now,
yeah.
That may be old fashioned thinking. I guess I wouldn't bet my life on what I'm saying here. That's my feeling, though.
No, I think that's great. And you know, I actually just taped a show with Joel Drucker, tennis journalist. I don't know if you know him, but
I know Joel Drucker. He was the guy that you were talking about, the nasty, tough little guy that you just don't want to play. Not fun. You must be like you're talking about Joel Drucker, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Joel Drucker. Irrestrippable kid, that guy is. Okay, well, anyway, no. Joel made the point that kids don't play practice matches. You know, I mean, your thing of playing 15 sets in a day, that's perfect. And, you know, I've got a young guy I'm working with right now, and I keep telling him, yeah, I mean, you spend this many hours with me, but you need to play matches, and you need to have a buddy who you say, all right, we're going to play this set, but the outcome doesn't matter, but I'm going to serve in volley. And or, hey, I want you to occasionally hit me a short ball to my backhand so I can approach, and then you tell me what you want me to do during this set so I can practice that shot in a live ball situation where there's an outcome to each point.
Yeah, and you don't have to play players that are better than you all the time either.
Otherwise,
you can
be
play
no
players
match.
That's weaker. You know, when I was playing, if I was playing a guy that I could beat relatively easily, then what I would do is I would try the most difficult shots that I could try. I mean, like it's easier in the backhand court to return cross court with your backhand. You know, so if I was playing someone that wasn't that good, I would practice returning down the line, you know, a lot. Or if he had a good side, I was serving and volleying in those days. I wouldn't use the first serve. I'd spin my second serve in to the guy's strength and then work on scrambling in and hitting the tough volley. I mean, you can get a lot of practice out of anyone that can keep the ball in the court a bit. I mean, you play to their strength.
Yeah, I mean, you might serve and volley first and second serve and then not even hit too tough of a serve so that you know that player is going to hit the ball back, right? Okay.
Right, I think guys practice. Yeah, they're practicing against a weaker player, and they're going for their bomber first serve. I mean, that doesn't even get them any practice. If they make it, they don't get a there's no return. You spin in the serve, depending. The objective of practice is to improve your game and mostly your weaknesses. I mean, you try to get a balanced game where you can hit every shot and you keep working on all of them.
Exactly. And you know, if everybody only played with someone better, then there'd never be a match. Okay, but let's go on to your book. Okay, I know you have a new, relatively new book out. So what can you tell us about that? And why should people who don't read actually stop and buy it and take a look at that new book? Which one is that?
Why should they bother? Well, point one, and I should add this about my background. While I was playing, I was at UCLA undergrad, and I got a PhD in psychology there. And so the interesting part of the game to me now became the mental part. And so I was writing for Tennis Magazine, and I probably wrote the first book. The first book on the mental game was Tim Galloway's book, The Inner Game. But that was a different approach. My approach to the mental game came from my experience personally on the court. It was more of a practical, do this when you choke, you know, and things like that. So the last book I wrote is called Tennis, Winning the Mental Match. And it comes from my years of consulting and coaching. I did coach Pepperdine for 16 years and coached players like Brad Gilbert and other number of pros. And I've worked with a lot of name professionals, which I won't brag and name. But anyway, what I found was that everybody has the same kinds of problems. You know, it'll start out the biggest problem in tennis is that it feels very important to win. We're hardwired to want to win tennis matches, in particular, more so even than a team match. Tennis feels important, and it feels very bad to lose, especially if you're really trying hard and it gets competitive. And so the rub is that no matter how hard you try, you can't be sure you'll win. The outcome is uncertain. And so when you play a difficult tennis match against somebody as good as you or better, you're under stress, under pressure for a long time, and you have to control yourself under pressure. And the emotions were not designed for that situation. Our emotional wiring is counterproductive mostly for a tennis match. In other words, you just allow your emotions to do what nature tells them to do. You will get angry when you miss. That's natural. You're frustrated. You wanted to make the shot and you missed it. Yeah. So of course you get mad, like a little kid doesn't get the toy. You will get discouraged when you get behind. Quite natural. You know, you will make excuses. You will find reasons. You know, you play doubles and you won't be happy with your partner if they make mistakes. You'll blame your equipment. You'll blame the wind. The wind is a problem. All of these things are very natural, and they're emotional responses that are counterproductive, and so they have to be controlled, which is not easy. It seems like it should be, but it isn't.
So your book gets into how to deal with those issues that come up in a match that run counter to our nature, so that then you can learn new habits and play better by second nature, by training, yeah?
Exactly. I mean, it's natural to get ahead, about to finish. It's natural to either ease up, you know, try to relax because the stress is growing, or to get frightened and choke on the verge of winning the set. I mean, tennis is a very diabolical game, actually. It's a tricky game. The scoring system in tennis is not like any other scoring system. At its very heart, it's different from all the other major sports. They're all the same, basically. Tennis is different. For instance, all the major sports like baseball, it's whoever has the most runs at the end of nine innings. Football, whoever got the most points after an hour. Same with basketball. Golf is the same also. It's just the opposite. Whoever has less points wins. In those sports, the points all count the same. Okay? I mean, a touchdown is a touchdown. It's 6 points. Right. Adds to your total. You know, so they're no different. Tennis is the only sport, you know, major sport, where the points don't count the same, all right? And it's that makes the game very, very stressful. For instance, you're playing a set, okay, and it's 1-all, 2-all, 3-all. You get to 5-4 or 6-5. If one of the players gets to set point, if the player wins that 1 point, that player gets the entire set, gets half of a match. 2 out of 3 sets, you've got half a match, your opponent gets 0. So you go from dead even. I mean, at 5-all, the two players are basically even. You know, the one player suddenly gets a set point and wins it. 2 even players, one guy's got half a match. That doesn't occur in other sports. You know, in basketball, the score would be 50-49. You know, in tennis, it's half a match to you and nothing for you. Yeah, that makes it really tough. And the games are like that, too. I mean, you go do sad, do sad, do sad. One guy, you can't tell me game point is not more important than the 50, than the first point or the 15 all point. I mean, you lose game point, you lose the whole game. If you lose the 15 all point, it's only 15-30.
Exactly.
You don't lose the whole game. You
want
to win the game.
We have about 10 minutes left, and I have a couple more questions. And I also want to have something I want to share. I want to give you credit for something. But from your book, Think to Win, which I absolutely love because it helped me win a lot more matches, and I used it with my coaching. Can you explain how it is that people get tricked into hitting down the line too early? Because I know a lot of that book has to do with the value of cross court. So,
yeah, it was that book was a strategy book, and there's a geometry in tennis. Like when there's positions that you play. For instance, if the ball is in the middle of your opponent's court, your best position is right in the middle of your court. Okay, you play right on the center line. As the ball gets near the sideline, you move towards the opposite sideline on your court. That's the geometric best position to play. So
yeah.
When you hit the ball cross court, you don't have to move very far to be in proper position for the next shot. Okay, you're on. Let's say you're hitting a forehand cross court. You're on the forehand side of the court, say near the forehand sideline. You don't even have to run all the way back to the center of the court to have your court covered properly. If you hit the ball down the line, you, in order to be in position for the next shot, you have to run all the way past the midline over to your backhand side. That's a longer run. So when you hit the ball cross court, it's safer. You don't have to hit as great a shot. When you hit down the line, that's more dangerous for a lot of reasons. I mean, court's shorter, net's higher, but also you're exposed. Your court's more open. And so you only hit down the line if you're smart. Well, there's two reasons. One is if your opponent has a very bad side. If their backhand's terrible and you have a forehand, well, hit it to their backhand, of course. But the other, the tactical reason you hit down the line is for aggression, for attack, because the ball will get you past your opponent in a shorter distance. You can hit a winner easier down the line than cross court. But what most people tend to do is they hit a ball cross court, and then they see opening, they see room on the back, on the down the line side, so they hit it there because there seems to be an opening. They don't realize that they're actually putting themselves in a worse position than they should be. Their court's exposed. They're going to run farther than their opponent is. You know, when I was playing, I used to wait. I used to hit my backhand cross court. And just wait. I'd wait for that person to hit down the line into my forehand. You know, if they did that, suddenly I could go on the offense. I had all kinds of options. You know, you can hit it cross court and give them a good run, or you can hit behind them and tack them. You know, I would just wait for that. I would just hope they would hit down the line.
When you get the short ball. When you get a short ball that you can really move in on and you're way inside the court, then you can go for that opening, right?
Then you hit down the line. You hit down the line when you're in a position to attack. They hit a shorter ball, all right?
Yeah.
Or they're, you know, you've moved them off cross court enough times that they're sort of hanging around there, and you get a relatively short ball, then you attack down the line. You sort of wait your opportunity. When in doubt, hit it cross court. You know, when you see an opening, an opportunity, something you can attack, then down the line's quite a good attack. Probably better than cross court, actually.
So, Alan, I want to thank you for having written that book, because as a result of reading that book, not only did it help me with my game, but I had a school where, I mean, basically the fundamental thing that I taught to all of my teams was very patient cross court play, which none of them with all their previous coaches had ever really been exposed to. And so one school I coached at, we won our first title in 26 years at the school. That was in my second year. Then another school, with another school, we snapped the boys team's 37-match league losing streak. And with the girls, we snapped their 71-match losing streak. They had not won a league match in 6 years.
Wow.
And then amazingly, though, this is the amazing part. At a school that was filled with ranked juniors who had all been to academies and taken a gazillion private lessons, I taught them to cross court, and they went from being a first-round sectional losing first-round team to winning the section championships within 2 years. And with the three seasons I had, during the playoffs, we upset two number two-seeded teams and two number one-seeded teams. And to win the championship, we had to beat two and one on the same day in 97-degree heat. So that was all thanks to what you taught through your book. Anyway, so we have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about underutilized strategies in tennis that would really help in today's game where, you know, with the polyester strings, everybody's hitting all this extreme spin. What's a tactic that people could use but they don't?
Well, it depends on what level you're talking. I mean, we could start with the pro level, by the way.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to change. It is changing a little bit gradually. And that is the transition from baseliner transitioning into the net to finish people off with the volley. As an example, Nadal and Djokovic in the final of the French Championship this year. I mean, it was a great match, and Djokovic had his chances, but in that match, Djokovic left a lot of money on the table. You know, what he would do is he would, you know, rope a ball into the corner where Nadal is on the dead run, and particularly on the back end where he's going to have to let go with one hand and chip the ball back. And he's going to chip it back high, you know, maybe 10 feet over the net and float it back deep. I mean, that's a ball, when Djokovic hits that shot, he should immediately be moving in and never let the guy chip the ball back high and finish him at the net. Okay, and I see because the game has gone so much towards a baseline game, and that's partially due to the power of the rackets, and people are hitting the ball harder, so they actually can put the ball away from the baseline, or be aggressive from the baseline. With the little rackets, people didn't do that very much.
What you should do is look to get your opponent moving, you know, really strongly sideways or backwards, and anticipate the floating ball, and kind of use the sneak into the net approach.
Right, quick. In other words, you have to see it almost as you hit your shot. When you're going to take, and it goes back to the idea that the game is a game of controlled risk. Okay, I mean,
yeah.
If you want to take a big risk and whack the ball and hit it very close to the line, I mean, you better win the point pretty quickly then. It better not just be, you better not have to hit 10 of those kind of shots. You only want to take your risk once. You take that risk, then you got to capitalize on it and finish the point off. And so if your opponent's floating the ball back at all, the thought should go back into your mind that you're allowing them to take a low-risk shot after you've hit a high-risk shot. If you keep doing things like that, you eventually lose. So you got to make a risky shot pay off. When you hit the down-the-line shot, the hard one, the tough one, you got to finish off the point pretty soon after that, which that's where the net is in. Moreover, if you allow your... The same thing goes for the occasional serve volley. I mean, if you see your opponent, you're hitting a hard, flat first serve, and you allow your opponent to just chip it back high and easy and take no risk, I mean, you're wasting quite a good serve. You need to take that ball in the air and volley it away and force your opponent now to hit a more difficult shot. If you're hitting a ball into the corner and your opponent realizes you're going to come to the net if they chip it, now they're going to have to hit a high-risk shot themselves. They're going to be in that bad position on the run. And they're going to have to ball, hit the ball low and hard. That's going to make them make more mistakes. I mean,
it seeds the thought. It seeds the thought that they're going to have to do something differently, and then they're going to hit a different kind of ball. And then, you know, one thing I like to have my kids do is serve and volley the very first point of a match. And then all of a sudden the other player kind of sets their mind, uh-oh, this guy's a serve and volleyer, so now I need to return low. And then the returns come low, and then you don't have to serve and volley because they're giving you a short ball. Now you can approach on that ball. So
go on.
Alan, so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it. And how can people reach you, or how can they find out more about your book and get a hold of you for that?
Well, I have a website called alanfoxtennis.net. I have articles on it and thoughts about things even beyond tennis. But they can purchase my books, you know, on my website. They can also get them at Tennis Warehouse or Amazon. I consult with players individually by telephone around the country. Right. So they can sign up for that on my website. And that's basically what I do. I do speaking at clubs and conventions, and that's also purchasable, or we can start a conversation on that through my website and emails. So, Bill, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you saying those nice things about my Think to Win book, my second book.
Yes, yes. No, thank you, and have a great day.
Okay, well, you too, Bill. Thanks again for having me on your show.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, so that was great. Thank you very much, Alan Fox. This next segment is brought to you by Pocket Radar. Pocket Radar wants you to hear from great pros who use it and find it to be a strong additional value to your lesson. Today we're going to be talking with Lisa Dodson about how she uses Pocket Radar. Lisa, what is the best thing that adds value to a lesson when you're using the Pocket Radar?
Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Good.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. And I'm looking at my Pocket Radar right now. It's just such a great teaching tool because, you know, everyone kind of wants to know some real information about what they do on the tennis court. And measurable information is what all great teachers use in order to have their students know if they're getting better or not. Because when progress is slow, which it can be in tennis, you don't really have any way to measure how much better have I gotten, right? And people, they have these great expectations of, wow, you know, I'm going to get better in an hour. And you really don't get that much better at tennis in an hour. So this is a tool that you can measure and see your improvement, which I think is just that's the value, the big value in itself. Most people want to see how fast they can hit a serve. And, you know, you've experienced that with high school boys coaching them, right, Bill? They want to see how hard can I hit this ball, right? And,
exactly.
You know, it really doesn't matter how hard you can hit it if it doesn't go in the box. So the way I really like to use this tool is I like to measure how fast a serve is going in that they can get in all the time, right? That's your go-to serve. That's, you know, your high percentage first serve. What's the speed that I can actually do that? And, you know, I think it's really important to people to know a number. You know, they don't have any idea whether they're serving 40 miles an hour or 90 miles an hour. And they have to realize that you're not going to jump 10 miles an hour in a couple of days. You have to kind of work up to that. So if you use this to measure, and it's so accurate and so easy to use, use it to measure what is my average speed that I can get in all the time. And now let me work on my technique so that I can gain, let me work on gaining 2 miles an hour, right? Not not 10 miles an hour. And let's get used to this idea that, yeah, you're going to swing the same speed on first serve, second serve, but your second serve is going to have a lot more spin, so it's going to travel slower. So you see that on TV all the time. Wow, it's 125 mile an hour serve, and their second serve is 91 miles an hour, even with the men. And get used to this idea that, you know, there is this differentiation in speed between first serve, second serve, even though you're swinging the same speed. And they get used to the idea of what they're really trying to attain out on the court is high percentage of serves. Yes, speed is important, but let's be realistic about it. And with this thing, you take it out on the court, and it's so accurate and it's so easy to use. You stand behind the player as opposed to the traditional radar guns, which are, I had several different things, you know, one that you sat up by the net and the ball would pass by and it wasn't very accurate and half the time you'd get a wrong reading. And with this, you stand behind the player and you press the meter button before they're about to strike the ball, and you get a very, very accurate reading on, you know, how fast that serve is going. So you're safe. You're standing behind. You can also, as a teacher, you know, I can also look at their technique as I'm doing it. I'll just have to hold this thing up in the air, and I can see what they're doing. And we can also say, oh, you know, that one was faster because you relaxed more at this point. Maybe, you know, you can pick out something that you've been working on and point out what you're actually seeing and make that correlation with more or less speed. So it's a great teaching tool. It's a great teaching tool.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's very detailed answers to that. And so that ends this particular segment of the Pocket Radar. So thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks, Bill. Have a great day.
All right. Terrific. All right, and so everybody, I got mine, and immediately the kids at camp perked up. There was amazing excitement, and you know, it's really one thing that I strongly recommend when you're going to use this with teenagers or for those who like to impress people is don't mention that you have a speed gun until everybody's all really warmed up, because you're just asking for a torn labrum or something like that. So yeah, make sure everybody's warmed up and have it programmed in. One comment from Linda LeClaire was that it may be better to use in private lessons because then there's not a comparison going on. So anyway, so if you're sitting at your computer right now, go ahead and go right to pocketradar.com, and or you can send them an email to info@pocketradar.com. And if you want to call them, it's 888-381-2672, 888-381-2762. Mention this show when you contact them, and they'll have a little surprise for you. Later we're going to have a discount code. But mention the show, and make sure you say thank you to Pocket Radar for sponsoring the show. In fact, thank you to all of you who are listening to the shows on the UR Tennis Network. I see that some of you are listening to past episodes, and I appreciate that. I strongly recommend for my show the Wayne Bryan, Steve Chandler, and Bryce Young, Linda LeClaire episodes. Feel free to send an email at schooloftennis@gmail.com or at schooloftennis, you can tweet me, @schooloftennis. Wherever you are, have a great day. Thanks for listening.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.